Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Purkis. Book 3, Chapter 3, Sychar. Accepting the hostile verdict of Jerusalem, Jesus turned northwards to Galilee. John tells us that he must needs go through Samaria. The need was a spiritual rather than a geographical one. Small parties of Jewish travellers almost invariably took the alternative route up the Jordan Valley, which avoided unfriendly contacts with the Samaritans. But a work was waiting for Jesus, and the events recorded in the fourth chapter of John's Gospel are both important and full of meaning. Toiling northward along the dusty road under the midday sun, Jesus with his little band of followers reached the ancient well on the outskirts of the town of Sychar. The disciples went on to get provisions while their master sank wearily down to rest. There is something at once saddening and satisfying about this picture. Saddening because of the knowledge it brings that in all the things that Jesus was to suffer, there was no alleviation of physical weakness. Satisfying because of the sense of fellowship it brings, the recognition that he knows the long and weary way. He has trodden the path along which he beckons us. His feet have been dusty and travel sore. He has sunk exhausted at the well. But the demands made upon him by his dedication to his Father's will were obeyed and maintained in spite of physical distress and tiredness of mind. His eager spirit soared above the limitations which nature continued to impose upon him. His restful contemplation was broken by the footfall of a Samaritan woman who came to draw water. There are good reasons why this interruption need not have disturbed his rest. In the first place, she was a woman, and as such she could be ignored. Then she was a Samaritan. A long and bitter feud existed between Jews and Samaritans. Finally, Jesus, who knew men's hearts so perfectly, would recognize at once in this woman one whose mode of life excluded her from decent society. None of these considerations weighed for one moment with him. His tiredness and hunger were at once forgotten as he looked upon this woman to whom his Father had sent him. "Give me to drink." Startled and perplexed, the woman repeated two of the reasons why such a question should not have been made. But as he had dealt with Nathanael and Nicodemus, so now he dealt with this woman. It was his custom to break through traditions which were merely stupid and meaningless, especially when they had their source in passion and hatred. "If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that said to thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldest ask of him, and he would have given thee living water." Not unnaturally, this unexpected reply brought a perplexed inquiry from the woman. She looked down at the spring water below her, then slowly back to the man who stood watching her. "Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence hast thou that living water?" Still Jesus refrained from answering her question, and gently continued the conquest of her soul. He persisted in the contrast between the water he has asked of her and the water he can give. This water will satisfy for a moment, and the need for it will return. But the water which can be his gift to her will satisfy for ever. Indeed, it will be an inward spring which will continue to quench her thirst until it finally wells up into everlasting life. The woman's reply seems to show that she was still bewildered, but she was impressed. She asked for Christ's gift, but her reason was that she would be saved the trouble of future visits to the well. Her response was limited by her ignorance, but it was a response, and there was no mockery in it. She was ready for the next lesson from her divine teacher. That lesson came in one short request which altered the whole situation. The gifts of God are not for selfish enjoyment. They have to be shared. Andrew has to find his brother. Philip has to find Nathaniel. And later the disciples will have to go into all the world. Go, call thy husband and come hither. The beam of light which had rested upon Jesus was now turned full upon her. The question probed her life, quickening her conscience. Unknown to her, it was a challenge to confess her sin, a challenge which was evaded. I have no husband. But Jesus was looking into her heart. He needed neither the confirmation nor the betrayal of her lips. He who saw the potential strength of Peter, who was with Nathanael under the fig tree, now told the woman that in her quick defence she had spoken the truth. She was not far removed from a woman of the streets making a trade of love. The glare of the light was too strong. Hastily she tried to move its penetrating rays away from herself. Perceiving that the man speaking to her was a prophet, she sought refuge in an important but impersonal question. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Gently Jesus led her back to herself with her disordered moral life, back to the living water which brings immortality, back to his Father, the source of all life. He paused only to concede one important fact in direct answer to her question. Salvation is of the Jews. Then he pointed beyond her question to a truth which, when fully perceived, made the question and the bitter consequences of its insistence quite unnecessary. It also restored the personal issue to the conversation. And however distasteful this may be to our conscience, it is the only possible ground from which it can be conducted. The hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. The woman was troubled at his answer. She had been unable to evade him. She realized that her inmost secrets lay exposed before him. She felt his love for her, but she could not understand his words. Perhaps it was a sudden premonition. Perhaps in her perplexity she turned to the hope that was not far from all her people. I know that Messiah cometh. When he is come, he will tell us all things. And then to the Samaritan woman, who had had five husbands and was living with a man not her husband, Jesus for the first time proclaimed his messiahship. I that speak unto thee am he. Leaving her water pot, the woman hurried back to the city to tell her neighbours. There is no longer any need to tell her to fetch her husband. She is anxious for all the city to come to Christ. This strange conversation is more than a passing incident in Christ's journey through Samaria. It discloses the nature of the intercourse which takes place between God and every true seeker after him. Our relationship begins with a demand from our Father to do something for him. Our natural feeling is that there is nothing that we can possibly do. He is the creator and sustainer of all things. We are puny creatures of his handiwork, utterly dependent and unworthy. Yet the demand persists, and with it comes the understanding that our service conceals a far greater gift from him. As the nature of that gift is unfolded in his word, so our desire for it grows. And although we can never appreciate it in its fullness, we plead for it. But it has its own demands. It requires us to expose all those things that are unworthy and demands that we share the gift with those around us. We cannot effectively accomplish the second without deliberately facing anything in our life which will impede our communion with God. There may easily be a strong temptation to evade this issue with specious reasoning and hypothetical problems. But we are brought back to the true issue of our personal relationship with God, and taught that in true worship lies the conquest of sinful flesh and the way of holiness. This is all brought to a focus in the person of Jesus Christ, and our surrender is complete when we truly believe his saying, "I that speak unto thee am he." The disciples, returning from the city with provisions, had seen their master talking earnestly with the woman. They wondered, but said nothing. Quietly they prepared the meal for him. Jesus was no longer exhausted and hungry. He was hardly conscious of the movement of the men around him. He was looking over the fields of waving corn towards the town which the woman was even now approaching. Finally, the disciples begged him to eat. In their anxious concern for him, they drew him back to temporal needs. But these things had lost all significance for him. "I have meat to eat that ye know not of." The disciples had much to learn. Their understanding was as dim as the woman's had been. They thought someone had offered him food while they were away. "My meat is to do the will of him that sent me, and to finish his work." He had eaten of that meat. The will of God has been done. Jesus compelled his disciples to look across the fields of ripening corn at the harvest that was already waiting to be gathered in. They looked at the corn and thought the harvest was 4 months away. But the sower watched the men of Sychar approaching and invited his disciples to share with him the joy of reaping. After the cold reception at Jerusalem, truly this was a joyous harvest, a prophetic one too, symbolizing the movement of the Gentiles towards him when his own people had rejected him. The Samaritans begged Jesus to stay with them. Many believed on him because of the words of the woman. Before he left, belief was confirmed by their own experience. "Now," they told the woman, "we believe not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves and know that this is indeed the Christ, the Saviour of the world." It is a blessed day when the disciple of Jesus can echo those words. Chapter 4. Galilee. Leaving Sychar, Jesus went northward into Galilee with his little band. The desolate expanses of rock and shrub they had left behind in Judea were forgotten as they reached their own fragrant countryside and heard once more the pleasant accents of their countrymen. The disciples' thoughts began to turn towards their lakeside homes, the families waiting for them, the gleaming lake and the nets. Jesus had made no demands of them yet, and they did not know that soon this dear, familiar background must fade almost completely from their lives. But he had been quietly preparing them, and now the last stage of that preparation was at hand, as he parted from them, probably for several months, leaving them alone with their families, their nets, and their thoughts. They would have plenty of time during the coming months to make their decision. In their homes and at their work, their thoughts would continually go back to the Jordan Valley, to Jerusalem, to Samaria. They would hear their countrymen earnestly discussing this Nazareth carpenter who had caused such consternation in the temple and had shown miraculous powers of healing in the city. Their minds would inevitably return to Jesus, and they would feel his compelling power in his very absence. There would be a feeling of futility in the daily tasks that in the past had always been so satisfying. They would long with an ever-growing yearning to see his face again, to hear his voice, to be with him. They would wonder what he was doing at that moment, whether he was near the lake or away in the northern hills. They were slowly coming to realize that they could not live without him. When he came back to them, a word would be all that was necessary to call them to follow him whithersoever he would lead. Meanwhile, Jesus made his way back to his own country. He came to Nazareth, the town that had become strangely remote. Its traders still noisily busy in the narrow streets, the neighbours working and talking, grumbling and suffering, as they had done for the past 100 years or more. From Nazareth he turned northeast to Cana, where he probably stayed with Nathanael, instructing him further in the deep things of the kingdom. A warm welcome would be waiting for him at the house of the young married couple, whose wedding he had attended nearly 12 months before. The attitude of the people was quite different now. News of his authority and power had been brought back from Jerusalem by those from the towns and villages of Galilee who had attended the feast. They received him with reverence and watched him in expectation. Nor were they disappointed, because it was whilst he was at Cana that he received a visit from a high official of Herod's court who was in great personal distress. His son lay at the point of death. Hearing that Jesus had returned from Judea, he travelled the 25 miles which separated Capernaum from Cana, and finding Jesus, besought him to return with him to heal his son. In view of the man's obvious faith shown by his making the arduous journey, the reply of Jesus must have sounded strange. "Except ye see signs and wonders, ye will not believe." But Jesus was going to use the occasion to bring greater blessings than the restoration of a dying boy. He was about to show the nobleman that the power of God vested in him did not need his actual presence at the scene of its ministry. There was no necessity to see the signs and wonders. Jesus may have been speaking to the nobleman near the fig tree in the garden where Nathanael had learned this lesson. The other apostles had yet to learn it. The countless company of disciples that have followed have had to understand that the power of Christ does not depend upon his physical presence. Herod's officer had shown a strong yet an imperfect faith in coming to Cana. Jesus sought to perfect it. For the moment the man's distress clouded his perception. "Sir," he cried, "come down ere my child die." Then Jesus made his meaning clearer by relating it to the man's personal trouble. "Go thy way, thy son liveth." There could be no doubt now, and looking steadily at Jesus, the man believed his word. Yet his faith was to be tried still further. It was impossible to start back for Capernaum in the growing dusk. He had to find an inn to spend a night filled with visions of the fever-ridden child he had left flushed and reckless on his pallet in Capernaum, and the quiet, confident rabbi here in Cana. At the first glimmer of dawn he would be on the road again, his new-found faith still keeping his fears at bay. A company of men were coming towards him. Suddenly he recognised one, and then another. They were household servants. He was not kept in suspense much longer. First their movements and then their faces revealed the good news that brought them to meet thy master. Thy son liveth! So his faith was vindicated. One thing remained, but the nobleman had little doubt what the answer would be when he asked his servants the hour when the change took place. It was the hour at which Jesus had spoken. The divine purpose was accomplished. The man believed, and his whole house. With a word, Jesus had saved more than the single life that was ebbing away in the quiet house at Capernaum. It is quite possible that the nobleman was Chuzzah, Herod's steward, and his wife Joanna, who showed her gratitude by joining the company of women who ministered unto Jesus of their substance. During the weeks that followed, Jesus remained in Galilee. From the absence of any record of his actions, it would appear that he spent the time in retirement. John was still preaching in Judea, preparing the people to receive their Messiah. The disciples, now returned to their daily tasks, were, all unknown to them, being prepared for the moment when their Lord would demand their complete surrender. Jesus could accept the last opportunity which would be afforded him to rest in the quiet seclusion of the Galilean hills until the next feast at Jerusalem called him forth to unceasing labour. We may perhaps pause for a few moments to look at this pleasant Galilean countryside where Jesus spent these quiet months, the scene of the greater part of his ministry. It is difficult to imagine the greater contrast than that between Judea and Galilee. The former was, for the most part, bare and forbidding, mountainous without the grandeur which can so often be associated with mountains. Apart from cultivated terraces around its towns and villages, it was almost devoid of trees and vegetation, a land of hot, dry rock and scrub stretching from the mountains of Samaria in the north to the wilderness of Zin in the south, and from the coastal plain in the west to the Jordan Valley in the east. Galilee was a beautiful country of hills and wide valleys, green fields and golden cornland. The reason for this startling difference in a country no larger than Wales was the great mountain range of Lebanon, which dominated Galilee in the north. From the snow-covered peaks of Lebanon and Hermon, there was a steady drop to the Sea of Galilee, which lay 700 feet below sea level. The effect of this was that the water flowed constantly down from the mountains, making Galilee a land of rushing streams, springs, and wells. Its valleys were green and fruitful, and its plains rich and well watered. The hard-working people accepted these natural blessings. They cultivated the plains and planted vine and olive groves on the lower slopes of the valleys. They grew corn and kept oxen and sheep. They cut the timber from the wooded hills, and they took the fish from the lake. It was a land open to the sun and the air, a land in which it was not difficult for any man to climb the height and rejoice in the creative power of God and praise his name. The great contrast between Judea and Galilee extended to the people. The Galileans were the true products of their countryside, vigorous, warm-hearted, not easily intimidated, headstrong to the point of rashness. It was in Galilee that the Romans had most of their disturbances. Many times the hot blood would surge, Roman soldiers would march, and Galilean patriots would pay the penalty of their impetuousness unflinchingly. It is interesting to notice that, although there was such a mixed population in Galilee, the Galilean Jews kept largely to their own cities. Jesus did not often go to the cities of the Gentiles in Galilee. There is no evidence in the Gospels that he ever visited Tiberias, although he was constantly in its vicinity. Nor do we read that he went to Sepphoris, which was only 5 miles from Nazareth, and lay on the road to Cana. Tiberias and Sepphoris were the two most important towns in Galilee, but they were Gentile strongholds. No reference to Galilee would be complete without mention of its roads. Every valley was a natural highway worn by the dusty feet of merchants, travellers, and pilgrims. Some roads even struggled down from the Lebanon mountain passes, trodden by those who preferred the perils of the land to the perils of the sea. Most famous of all these roads was the one which Isaiah called the Way of the Sea, connecting Damascus with ports of the Mediterranean Sea. It carried not only the merchandise of Syria, but connected the countries of the East with Europe. Recognizing its importance, the Romans paved it and exacted a tax on its traffic. One of the taxing points was at Capernaum, and one of the tax gatherers there was Matthew, waiting even now for the call of Jesus. It was in this beautiful part of the Holy Land, among these busy, warm-hearted people, that Jesus spent the longest and happiest part of his ministry. With the sad exception of the people of his own town, he largely won their affection and loyalty. And although serious attempts were made from Judea to loose the hold he had on the Galileans, attempts which closed the doors of the synagogues against him, they did not really succeed, and many of the people remained faithful to the end. Thoughtful readings of the Gospels will convince us that as the hostility of the Jews intensified at the end of Christ's mortal life, Galilean hands strewed palm trees along the road to Jerusalem, and Galilean voices cried, "Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord!" Earlier they had unsuccessfully tried to take him by force and make him king. Now they felt their hopes were to be realized, and though by his subsequent actions Jesus frustrated them, they remained faithful throughout the last dark week. The people whom the temple authorities feared when they attempted to arrest him on at least 3 of the days were not the reserved, law-ridden Jews of the city, but the people who had come down from Galilee to the Passover. It was their presence which caused Caiaphas to take Jesus in the middle of the night, rush through the Jewish trial in the early hours of the morning, and get him condemned by Pilate before they realized what had happened. We do not know how long Jesus enjoyed the quietness of the Galilean hills, because we can only assume by vague indications which feast it was which Jesus attended in Jerusalem. It could not have been less than 3 months, nor more than 9. But with the disciples now ready for the supreme surrender of apostleship, with the net closing relentlessly around John in the desert, Jesus turned southwards once more and began the active phase of his ministry from which there could be no respite and no turning back.